Finding Osama bin Laden, dead or alive, was the top priority at the start of the U.S.-led war on terrorism. But thousands of bombing raids and special operations later, Washington remains fiercely divided over bin Laden's fate.
Officially, the Defense Department says it simply doesn't know where he might be hiding. But others in Washington believe there are increasing signs that bin Laden is dead. As the controversy continues, journalist Robert Fisk believes one thing is for certain. The world's most wanted man survived the early months of the war. Fisk, who says he's interviewed bin Laden on three separate occasions, recently spoke with our Cliff Brockman.
Well, the first time was in Sudan. And a Saudi friend of mine was attending a conference which I was covering. And he said to me, "I'm going to meet Osama bin Laden tomorrow in the desert. Would you like to come along?" To which I said, "Yes, yes, yes." No foreign correspondent had met him before. He didn't know I was coming. I did ask him about the State Department's claims. You remember, we're talking 93, 94, a long time ago. But what I really wanted to know about was how his mind worked. So I asked him about his time in Afghanistan when he and his fellow Arab fighters fought the Soviet army. For us, of course, they were our heroes at the time. And he gave me a lot of information. He told me one particular story that he felt had changed his life, and that's where he was attacking a Soviet mortar position in Nangarhar province in Afghanistan, and a Russian mortar fell right at his feet. And in the millisecond before it exploded and killed him, he said he felt great calmness. And he attributed this to being a religious experience. Now, fortunately for him, and perhaps unfortunately for the people of the United States, the mortar did not explode. But it's clear that that marked him, or marked his mind and the way he thought. Another very important issue for him was the fact that when he returned from Afghanistan, having, after all, played a leading role in driving the second most powerful army in the world, the Russian army, out of that country, just after that, in 1990, Saddam Hussein and Iraq invaded Kuwait. And he went immediately to the Saudi royal family and said, "Look, don't bring in the Americans. I and my fighters from Afghanistan will drive the Iraqis out. We'll make their life hell. We'll get the Iraqis out. Let the Arabs deal with the Arabs." And to his immense fury, and I'm sure his wounded pride, the Saudi royal family decided that they would prefer the Americans to do the job. That, I think, was a very important moment in Osama bin Laden's life. The next time I met him, I received a call from Europe asking me to go to see, I think the quote was, "the man you saw in Sudan." So I waited a couple of weeks and I went to Jalalabad, which is a town in southwest Afghanistan. And I must have waited for another 2 weeks before one day I heard a car keys on my bedroom window, which is on the first floor. And a man said, "Mr. Robert, we've come to take you to Sheikh Osama." And we set off for hours and hours over the countryside, through minefields, past mud villages that had been destroyed by Russian bombs, filled with naked babies climbing over the rubble. Extraordinary scenes out of an apocalyptic movie. Eventually, at dusk, I think it was the following day, we arrived at a river which was very shallow, and we had to walk across it through the water. On the other side was an orchard with some military camp beds with a lot of armed men lying, sleeping, sitting, reading on them. These, of course, were bin Laden's fighters. These were al-Qaeda, or the people who would become members of al-Qaeda when he formed the group. And beyond was a sort of mud hut, and inside there was a light flickering, and coming out with someone holding a paraffin lamp beside him was bin Laden. I recognized him at once, of course. And we sat there by this paraffin lamp. I took pictures of him and of his two sons, his two teenage sons. And those pictures went around the globe afterwards, of course. And he talked for 2 hours about the evils and wickedness of the Saudi regime. There's no doubt, I mean, put America to one side, put Iraqi sanctions, Israeli occupation of Palestinian land, it is Arabia he concentrates on. He wants the overthrow of that royal family, which he regarded as corrupt. The next time I met him was the following year, 1997, when I got another call from a different part of Europe. And I managed to get back to another town in Afghanistan. This time, same thing, car keys in the bedroom window. I deliberately chose a bedroom on the ground floor. And this time I was taken for hours and hours of journey high into the mountains, so high there were clouds below me and the waterfalls were hanging in ice above me. We went high up into one of his camps. And I sat in a tent next to a huge air raid shelter cut into the living rock, 25 feet by 25 feet, and eventually bin Laden arrived. For some time, all he wanted to do was read the Arabic language newspapers that he caught sight of in my bag. not the kind of guy you thought who was in constant satellite touch with the rest of the world. But I do remember the last thing he said to me that night in the tent with this sort of sputtering paraffin lamp, and that was, he said, "Mr. Robert, from the mountain upon which you are sitting now, we destroyed the Russian army and helped to get rid of the Soviet Union," which I must say I thought was pretty accurate. He probably played a pretty leading role in getting... He was wounded 6 times fighting the Russians. But then he said, "And Mr. Robert, I pray to God that he allows us to turn America into a shadow of itself." And I wrote it down. I'd been back to my notes. That's exactly what he said, word perfect. In fact, I was so keen to get it right that one of his fighters, one of the Al-Qaeda people, wrote it out in Arabic, and I have the Arabic text in that man's handwriting as well.
Have you had any contact with him since September 11th?
None. I do know that during the American bombardment, he met a man whom I later met who said he asked after me. He asked where I was. I wasn't in Afghanistan. I gather he wanted to speak to me, but I wasn't there, so I don't know anymore. And since the since that date, which was sometime, may have been November actually, but since then I've had no message and I've not attempted to make any contact, and I have no evidence whether he's dead or alive. Don't know at all. I suspect he is, because I thought his security when I met him was extremely good, very professional. I thought the people around him were ready to give their lives for him. They hung on his every word as if he was a messiah. Well, he's not a messiah, but I mean, that's what they were like.
You were almost killed last fall.
It was December 8th. I was trying to get to Kandahar in Afghanistan. I was approaching the Afghan border. And by great misfortune, my car broke down. It overheated in a village in which there were a large number of Afghan refugees whose relatives had just been killed under a hail of bombs from B-52s. American bombs had killed their families. I was a Westerner. They thought I was an American. I was attacked by about 10 or 12 men who started with stones, banging the stones into my face. They weren't throwing them, they were banging them, or other people were bouncing stones off my head. And an ever-increasing crowd, I guess it was 50 by the end. I was covered in blood from head to toe. My glasses were smashed. My face was bleeding. My skull was cut open. And I remember it going through my mind, how long does it last? Obviously, I was anticipating that it was going to be the end of me. And I also then remembered that during the Lebanon War, the Lebanese had always said to me, whatever you do, don't do nothing. So I turned around, and although I couldn't see very well, I had so much blood in my eyes, I started bashing. And just for a moment, the crowd withdrew from me. And in that moment, I walked out and ran out. And then I couldn't see clearly because of the blood in my eyes, but a religious man, I mean a Muslim, in a long robe and a turban, took me by the right arm and led me down the road away from this huge crowd of people, ever growing greater, of course.
You said later that if you had been in their position,
I would have done the same thing.
Yeah.
I wrote my story. Well, I mean, these were truly, you know, their crime was to be a victim of the world. Their families had been destroyed, their homes had been destroyed by us in our favorite war on terror. It was they who would become the victims of our war on terror. I began and ended my story saying if I was them, I would have done the same to Robert Fisk. I said it for two reasons. Firstly, because it was true. And secondly, I get very sick of reporting which always refers to Westerners being killed by Afghan or Muslim mobs, as if Muslims are somehow generically violent. These people had a reason for being angry, and I didn't intend that reporting of it should delete the reasons, the why question. Just as we shouldn't allow people to stop us asking why about September the 11th, We have to ask why about every incident of violence. The motive is important.
Author and journalist Robert Fisk has covered foreign affairs for 25 years. He currently writes for The Independent of London. For Common Ground, I'm Cliff Brockman.